Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Exchange. This is Cheryl Castile. My guests in the studio today are all associated with an incredible, incredible resource that we have here in our community and here at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, the Center for Louisiana Studies, who are celebrating their 40th year anniversary. It's great that we have in the studio today the director, Dr. Michael Martin. We have James Wilson, who's the associate director of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. And we have John, or some people know him, Pud, because John, I've said your name, John Sharp, and some people don't get who you are until you say Pud. So however you know him, he's here, and he's the assistant director for research at the Center for Louisiana Studies. So welcome, everybody.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's
Thanks,
great
Sarah.
To have you here. 40 years is a long time, and who's of the three of you who's been here the longest in this?
I've been at the center the longest. Yeah. Michael's been at UL the longest, I think.
Yeah, yeah, here at the university. And James, you started out
in 2004.
Okay. And what did you start doing then at the center?
I was with the press from when I first came there.
Okay. What's your background? What led you into that part of the
department?
Well,
my background's in history, and I did my undergraduate work in New Orleans at Tulane. And
where'd you grow up?
In Baton Rouge.
Oh, okay.
And so one of my professors at Tulane saw that I had an interest in Louisiana history. She had published in Louisiana History. And I never knew that you could make a career of, like, history or anything like that. You know, I thought it was one of those humanities degrees that made you a well-rounded person but, you know, wasn't really marketable. She said, you like Louisiana history. You have to go see Carl Brasso and Glenn Conrad over at UL. And so I came over here for a master's degree, and that's where I became associated with the center. I did some work there, went off, continued my studies, and was fortunate enough to come back in 2004.
Wow. So what have you seen happen with the UL Press, with the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press, since you have been there? I mean, you must have seen some changes.
Well, because I was interested in Louisiana and Louisiana history, you know, I was familiar with the titles and, you know, I had most of the books prior to even coming there. So I knew what was happening all the way back into the 80s. And although I wasn't, into it when I was younger, I collected those books over time, the ones from the 70s, because they're important reference books. They were benchmarks for Louisiana history and Louisiana studies. So I was familiar with what was going on before I even came there. But the big change that I've seen is increased attention to the production of the books, the graphic design, the transformation in the way books are printed, going to more digital printing and electronic copies, those sorts of things. So with those changes, we've seen an increase in sales and revenue that's generated by the press. So we're not really publishing all that many more books per year than we had published in the past, but I think the quality has really been elevated significantly.
In the publications there, so for the state of Louisiana, you are the second largest academic publisher.
Right.
Correct. And you're the largest publisher, academic publisher of Louisiana-related works.
Right. And we're probably the largest publisher of exclusively Louisiana works.
I mean, that's
really what our focus is, and that's what we know, and that's what we do. And it's not just because that's the content we know, but that's where our distribution networks lie.
Yeah.
We're able to distribute authors well to that region.
Do you know what I noticed when I was in all your offices, and it was, you know, having a meeting with Michael, it was, I don't know, maybe a month and a half ago or something, but you have in the one office where you have a number of the books like up on shelves, the covers, you know, regardless of what they're about, the covers, you know, so what you talk about too with the quality, the covers like draw you right in.
Yeah, and that's
they're
a
beautiful.
Challenge because most presses, whether they're trade publishers or academic publishers, have access to graphic designers. You know, they can hire them contract employees if they're not full-time employees. And we do a lot of that in-house,
almost all of it in-house.
And so for a long time, it was very formulaic with the publications that the center did. Back when they were the Center for Louisiana Studies, they were publishing under that imprint. It was kind of formulaic, and they all kind of looked alike.
Yeah, sure.
But when I came on board, when Jennifer Guidry, who was helping at that time with the publications, we tried to really challenge ourselves to make the books look different and learn things about graphic design and make them look aesthetically pleasing and different.
Yeah, because that marketing part of that, I mean, I think everybody knows that, you know, people a lot of times, and I'm a perfect example, will get drawn to a book not even knowing what it's about, but because of that look or the artwork that's on the cover, you know.
It's a good marketing tool. It's the artwork on the cover, but also the book itself. There's so much to it, the way it feels, how the paper, the weight, the thickness of the book. There's a lot of different components that you try to pay attention to.
And interesting, the man of history that goes that you collect.
Oh, yeah. That's why it's a perfect job. I love it. I think we would all pretty much agree our jobs are great. And, you know, we thank our blessings every day for what we're allowed to do.
In there. And Michael Martin, Dr. Martin, I'm going to switch over to you for a second. But now you have been at the university the longest.
Yes. I've been here since 2003 as a faculty member. And I've been at the Center for Louisiana Studies for now a little bit more than 2 years.
2 years.
I started August 1st, 2011.
As the director there.
As the director, yes.
So what were you doing prior here at the
university? I was on the faculty of history in the history, geography and philosophy department, yeah. Yeah, in fact, James and I go way back. We both got our master's degrees here when it was USL back in the mid-1990s.
So. Yeah.
So we both have an affiliation with the center stretching back to then.
Well, you know, and I found out recently, and I'm trying to remember who, but your father, real involved with – like history archives or?
Not so much my father as my grandparents.
Oh, is that who it was? Your grandfather? Okay.
Yeah. My grandfather he wasn't a trained historian, but he did a lot of research.
And was it here at the university that he did a lot of work or just around the area?
It was throughout South Louisiana. My grandmother is a genealogist. And
do you know Judge Brinkman, Bobby Brinkman? Judge Brinkman?
I don't think so. No,
I was thinking that's who had told me that.
Yeah.
I think he knew your grandfather.
Quite likely, yeah. Lots of people knew my grandfather. Yes.
Okay.
He was more of an amateur historian, but it's really from my grandparents that I got that passion for history. For people who've met my grandmother, who's still with us, they understand that being around them as I was growing up, there was really no other option for me. I was going to be fascinated with history, and then like James, when I figured out I could actually do this for a living, it's almost like a dream come true.
What was it about your grandparents, their involvement with history? What was it that grabbed you? What?
Well, for them, it's very much about the stories of history. You know, my grandfather was a great storyteller. My grandmother, in some ways, he was a better storyteller, but she's better at writing down stories. So it was about the narrative. It was about the interesting kind of quirky people that you had encountered as children or knew about from the past and those sort of things. But growing up, and I spent a lot of time at their house when I was growing up always kind of lived in the same neighborhood, at least for much of my life. So growing up around people like that, you're just kind of surrounded by the past. You're surrounded by family stories, by the kind of more popular stories of history, surrounded by books. So when I started going to school at what was then USL, and I met people like Carl Brasso, Glenn Conrad, and some other people who would later be my colleagues, I knew them because I'd seen their names on my grandparents' bookshelves.
Yeah.
Carl Brasso, who was my predecessor as director of the center, my grandmother still says this, he's my idol. So, you know, she had every book by Carl Brasso. He signed every copy of it. And when she figured out that I was taking classes with him, then later I was working with him, and then when he retired that I eventually kind of took over as director, it's one of the things that I think makes her quite proud.
Oh, yeah, what a cool connection for her. Yeah. Wow. Very nice. So you've been at the center now for 2 years.
Yes.
And, you know, a bit about what James was talking about. What have you seen change or evolve even in the last, you know, couple years?
Sure. I think – and really I'm just going to kind of continue on with what James said. The quality of the layout, the quality of design has continued to evolve and, yeah. and get much better. And that's true just over the last 2 years, but certainly going all the way back to the time that James and Jennifer started roughly the same time. The other thing that I see changing is because the nature of publishing is changing so rapidly, generally, yeah. that other academic presses and even some other trade presses are facing difficult decisions and having to sometimes curtail their publication
and changing programs. Because
of the economy, but also because of the nature of competition from okay. online resources, digital books, and things of that nature, and self-publication. I mean, yeah. It's much more widely available for people to self-publish books. But what I see happening is that other presses are limiting their publication program. And to some extent, they're doing it in a very kind of heavy-handed way. And in many cases, they're excluding books that are very valuable, that need to be on bookshelves, and that have a wide market. And as a result of that, we're getting more and more submissions. Mm. So I've seen the submission rate grow just in the last 2 years, and I also think that allows us to be even more selective. So the quality of the subject matter, the internal components of the book, is getting better as well.
Yeah.
For example, speaking to what Michael's saying, there was a academic publisher here in this region who recently decided, well, we're not going to do much Civil War anymore. And they historically had been known for doing really good work on the Civil War. And so when they stopped that, we get increased manuscript submissions on that topic.
Oh,
so
sure.
We had a great Civil War book come out just earlier this year. Mm-hmm. Same thing with fiction. A lot of academic publishers are going away from publishing fiction. They just don't want to take the risk on it or have to put in the legwork. Fiction takes a lot of commitment on the author's part to promote it. So we've been the beneficiary of those other presses scaling back in just those two fields, for example.
So, and part of what you do with the publishing end of it, do you solicit projects?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the most important things we do is we build relationships with authors.
Okay.
Sometimes they've already submitted something to us. Sometimes we hope that they have something that they're working on that we would be interested in. And other times it's just to, you know, make friends and get to know them. But that reaps long-term benefits.
And is that based, Michael, and might be a little of both, on a specific author or a subject matter that you go out seeking?
It's variable. I think sometimes we know authors that we want to work with, okay. or we know authors who are capable of producing a book that we think needs to be written.
I got it.
And then other times, so often we're sitting around the office or we're on the road to somewhere and we're saying, you know, there needs to be a book on this.
Yep.
They're really, you know, why is there not a book on? If this book was there, we'd sell 1,000 copies the first day, you know, that sort of thing.
We have a long list of those books that need to be written.
Yeah.
And it's we're fortunate when they're that rare occasion you have someone who has that same desire and interest and they actually have written the book and it comes together.
So. I'm curious about the two of you. Have either of you written a book or – because you have, Michael.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And more than one?
Yes. Yeah.
And what has the subject matter been for those?
Oh, they're pretty wide-ranging. The first book I wrote was a history of an academic department at a university that I was attending at the time. The second was a local history of Lafayette that was intended very much for a non-academic popular market. And I've just completed a biography of Senator Russell Long, who was senator from 1948 to 86 from Louisiana, and of course son of Huey, nephew of Earl Long, which is very much an academic work.
Yeah.
So those are the three that I've written myself.
And it makes it nice, though, to understand, you know, that process that people have to go through.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always think, too, that when you get to – towards the end of that process, you know, if you are not self-publishing, I mean, there's that fear of rejection. You know, how do you get yourself over that hump to submit, you know?
It certainly helped me in relating to the authors.
Yeah.
Partly because, you know, sometimes even with the books that I've done, there is that kind of barrier between the publisher and the author. where the publisher says, okay, you need to fix this in your manuscript, change this, revise, whatever. To get that letter can be sometimes like a knife to the heart.
because you think,
I've worked on this for 5-6 years, and then suddenly there's still all these huge changes. So in some ways it's helped me understand what the author's going through and why, you know, why authors may feel the way they feel or why they may take some extra time to complete a book project or whatever.
Right.
But then on the other hand, working on this side has made it much clearer for me why the publishers say the things that they do.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, it's very beneficial to me, and I hope it's beneficial to our authors as well.
That's right. James, have you written?
I edited a book with Carl back in the 90s, so that was the only one that has my name on it.
Yeah, yeah. Which one was that?
The supplement to the Dictionary of Louisiana Biography.
Ah, okay.
So that was, I think, 97.
Okay.
When I worked on that. But no, but I feel like I've got a real interest in almost every book we do because I do a lot of the design and layout, nearly all of it. So it's – I feel like I've got a strong investment in the project. So.
Yeah. You know, prior to working here in terms of design and layout, was there some artistic interest that you had?
No.
Just period? No.
Books, yes.
Ah.
Michael was talking about his background and being surrounded by books. Well, I wasn't. You know, we had the encyclopedia and that was about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But – what I'm really passionate about, I love Louisiana history, I love the culture and everything, but I love books and just the actual object, even more so than the contents in many cases.
Yeah.
So being able to combine my interest in Louisiana history with books is just a dream come true.
Do you go to like old used bookstores and
see?
There's
In Country Roads, the magazine out of Baton Rouge, there's a column called Antiquarians.
Yeah.
And I was the first person profile there in my book collection. So I've got things going all the way back to the 18th century.
Oh, very cool.
Very big collection.
Yeah. So, okay, well, that's a nice combination with the two of you. Yeah, very
it's
cool.
A dynamic duo.
Yeah, there you go. Well, John, let's move to you.
Okay.
All right. So you're the assistant director for research. What all does that entail?
Well, that means that I conduct research at the center, which currently is the majority of my time conducting the research is the dance hall project that I've been working on.
So how does that get decided? You know, in terms of what your focus is going to be, what the research.
I think. This got decided because I was already doing it when Michael came on.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, he was working on it when I was hired, and then when we hired him full time, he was still working on it.
Yeah.
So it just became part of what we do. There's a, but we also have a kind of running list of projects, some of which are at the top and some of which are further down.
Yeah.
And as we finish one, you move on to the next.
Sure.
And you're also a musician, so that.
Well, and in a previous life, I was a musician. So
we never know when that comes back.
Yeah, that's true. So that, in a large way, you know, made me interested in music. So I also conduct, in addition to conducting research, I help researchers who come in together with Chris Segura, who's our archivist, and quite frequently Jennifer Guidry, who is the What's Jennifer's title?
Assistant Director for Programming and Special Projects.
For Programming and Special Projects. I'm sorry.
And mother to a newborn. So we'll throw that in there.
Right.
Yeah. All right.
And so we, in addition to those things, I work with Chris Agura in the Archives of Cajun and Creole Folklore, which means spending quite a bit of time. Being good stewards of that material, making sure that it's backed up, making sure that we have high-resolution copies, and also attempting to track down new material for the archive.
Yeah,
coming in contact with people, and you know, just anywhere from the grocery store to them walking into my office to you know. Find shared interests and the possibility of collections that are, you know, need to be digitized and housed in an archive.
Was there a recent experience that an encounter you had that was just very cool. It was like, oh my God, we need to focus on someday.
Oh, sure. One of the things that I look forward to doing is Lafayette Urban Mardi Gras.
Yeah.
Field work. Because of the box hat tradition.
Yeah.
Is not largely known and very, very little documentation work other than, I think, one paper. So that's one thing that always stays pretty close to my mind.
Yeah.
But as of right now, I'm overly saturated with dance hall.
Yeah.
It's hard to think about much of anything
else. So where are things at with that project? Can we talk about that a
sure.
little bit?
Sure. I'm hoping to maybe be done by the beginning of the year with filming. And I'm also working on a website that is funded by the Lafayette Convention and Visitor Center. Hopefully the website will be online by the end of the year, and then hopefully at the beginning of the year my film field work will be done, and then we can start to talk about other research ideas.
Yeah, it's covering what area?
The entire state.
Okay, the entire state you're doing.
But
yeah,
you know, for the most part that means
that's a lot.
That for the most part that means the South Central.
Yeah, but you think about. I think about a lot of those old dance halls and very family connected. You must have discovered just some great family stories.
Oh, sure. And, much like Michael, that's the thing that got me into this as an idea of something to do for a living is just loving people and wanting to be around the stories and that you just never know what you'll hear and these connections that we don't think about that we share.
Yeah. So do you have a projected, like in a year or within the next year sometime, or you don't really know right now?
Probably no.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love to have it done by spring next year.
Okay. Well, let's listen and see. So we're going to skip down that list a bit because we're going to listen to one of the dance hall tunes. The compilation, the songs that you all brought in today – those are all pieces that are housed within the archives?
Right.
It's the archives of Cajun and Creole folklore.
Okay. And one we're going to listen to is Cyprien Landrenault. And that is the BD. Is it BD Sparkle Waltz?
It's the B.O. Sparkle Waltz.
B.O. I wrote it down wrong.
And the B.O. Sparkle Waltz was a dance hall in Bridge City, Texas. So the, Cajuns that relocated – to the Texas area, that was it's a borderline city and a very famous Cajun dance hall.
Yeah, because for doing that document, you really had to cross over the state line.
Yeah,
to Texas
sure
when you think about.
But only the Texas state line.
Yeah, only the Texas state line. All right, this is Cyprien Landrenault.
Thank you.
That was Cyprian Landrineau. If you just joined us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web at krvs.org. Please check out the website, too. It's a great resource for international, national, and local news, and also events going on in the area. And if you missed a show or just want to hear a repeat, the archives and the podcast for all the locally produced shows that are here, as well as things like World Cafe. So my guests in the studio today was Center for Louisiana Studies, who are celebrating their 40th anniversary. I have Dr. Michael. That was a combination of Dr. Michael. Dr. Michael Martin, who's the director of the Center for Louisiana Studies, assistant director. Jennifer Guidry could not be here today, but we're going to give her a hello for programming and what is that? Special programming and projects?
Programming and special projects.
There we go. Programming and special projects. But who else we do have in the studio today is the Assistant Director for Research, John Pudsharp, and the Associate Director at the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press, James Wilson. With 40 years, you know, when you look at what the center, and just when you look at the website, you get a pretty good overview of what the center focuses on, and it looks at archives and collections, programming, and then publications. And something that I had mentioned before we went on air, but the thing that's so impressive about what you all do there is how much you all do there. And I think sometimes people really, you know, don't realize how much comes out of there. Besides some of the day-to-day tasks that you also have to do. But the history, 40 years is a long time. Can you tell us a little bit about how that center became?
Sure. So we've done a lot of digging in the archives, but we've also, of course, talked with a lot of people who were around at the beginning of the center. And the story goes something like this. In the early 1970s, there were really three men affiliated with the university who kind of led the charge to get the center created. First and foremost was Glenn Conrad, who was a historian. He was teaching in the history department, but also was overseeing the university's archives in Duperrey Library. Secondly was Dr. Amos Simpson, who was among the founders of the history department here at what was then USL. And I don't think he was still a department head, but was still a towering figure in the department at that point. And Dr. Odomaugh, who was not quite president yet. He was still acting president.
Okay.
Mr. Conrad, Glenn, came up with a program and kind of a plan of action. And in the summer of 1973, that plan or proposal was approved first by the head of the history department and then by Dr. Odomaugh. It brought together a number of divergent activities, some of which were already happening and some of which were being planned at the time. Hmm. The university already had an archival series of collections. Mr. Conrad was already overseeing those. The university already had a publishing operation. It was at that point called the USL History Series, and it published its first books in 1970 or thereabouts.
Yeah, and there were a few titles that were just spotty titles that were published in the 60s that the university published, but it wasn't any type of series or anything formal.
Yeah, so the publications actually precede the creation of the center.
Yeah.
But with the inception of the center in 1973, the publications found a home. It continued to be the USL History Series for a while. For a time, it was USL.
USL
Press imprint. Then it became sort of standardized as the Center for Louisiana Studies imprint, so that by the 1980s, really, that was the only thing you see on the books. And then about 4 years ago, it was changed, of course, to the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press. So you had publications and archives. Those things were already happening. There, of course, had been some public outreach and programming going on affiliated with various departments at the university. But the proposal stated that really for the first time there would be an actual plan for doing those sort of projects and a home for those projects.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, those are the three things that we still engage in, research as well. There were some things that were proposed that never really came to fruition, as far as I can tell, including an educational component or a more standard academic component where there would actually be, I guess, a Louisiana Studies major or something like that.
Okay.
But beyond that, everything else came to fruition and is still kind of chugging along in my way of thinking, at a much higher level than ever.
Yeah.
And there was also the opportunity to house the state historical journal that came about in 73. And that was one of these other things were in the plans, but the spark that really pushed it in 73 was the editorship of the state historical journal, Louisiana History, had come up for renewal. And so it gave us an opportunity to put in a bid to house that here.
Yeah.
And so the center was going to be responsible for that. Mr. Conrad became the managing editor of that journal, and the journal's been housed here ever since.
Yeah. It's thanks for reminding me of that, James. That really was, I think, the final impetus for bringing all these things together. The journal had been housed at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, but since 1973, it's been here, and even today the center functions as kind of an unofficial headquarters, or maybe an official headquarters.
Well, it's official.
Yeah, that's right. It says it on our door, Louisiana Historical Association.
Yeah.
And I'm the managing editor of the journal, and James is the secretary treasurer for the association.
I do want to mention, because a lot of times people, you know, have to get back to work and do things, but we'll bring it up again towards the end. But tomorrow, November 6th, is the open house, and from 9 to 11:30, and the center is located on the third floor of Duperrey Library. Library in rooms 313 and 321. I really encourage anybody who can get out and go to that open house, because it's really amazing what goes on in there. And for you to really, you know, I think sometimes you hear about these places and, you know, you really have no idea what it's like inside. Go ahead.
We're also going to offer a special 40% discount. We've never done anything that dramatic, 40% discount on all of our books.
Get those noisemakers going, Cecil.
So 40% off of all our titles tomorrow if people come into the office. Yeah. We'll also honor that on online sales so they can go to our website.
That's a great deal.
One day only.
Holy cow. Okay.
So new titles, old titles.
Yeah, that's a really good deal.
That's 1% off for every year, 40 years.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I didn't catch that until. But really, folks, and then there's a half-day symposium that we'll talk about in a little bit. But that is tomorrow from 9 to 11:30 is the open house. And it gives people, too, a great idea when you can get in there. I think that's really encouraging for people to go back than to go explore, you know, what's in the archives, and to go, you know, read and listen and, you know, everything that you can do up there. But I just wanted to mention that, you know, for folks that may have to leave us here. Yeah. Go ahead, John.
And we'll have two listening stations tomorrow. So the archives of Cajun Creole folklore, all of our material that is digitized will be readily available for you to listen or view at the click of a button.
Very nice.
Yeah, I definitely encourage people to come in.
Yeah, because sometimes that's a bit intimidating. You know, for people that don't know what they're like, oh, am I going to be able to work the equipment? Is somebody going to help me?
It's all super easy.
And there's always people there to help you.
Definitely.
That's right. Yeah,
yeah. So check it out tomorrow. Yeah. So then let's go back. I'm sorry.
Sure.
But I just wanted to get that in so folks knew when that was going on tomorrow.
Yeah, and so tomorrow we'll be celebrating the history of the center, the people who've worked there, the work that's been done, and the ongoing activities that continue to kind of define what the center is today.
Yeah.
We'll have a pretty big announcement to make. Can't share that right now. It's got to wait until tomorrow.
Teasers.
But it'll be something that's big news, we'll say, for people who are interested in the center, and I think also interested in the university as well.
Yeah. And, you know, with your archives in the collections, you have – it's some of the nation's largest microfilm – collections of French and Spanish colonial records. No, that's not correct.
Actually, that's something we've just recently migrated over to the university's archives.
They're right next door.
And we can still provide.
But they're
guidance.
Still here.
That was an important part of the founding as well. Though Glenn set out on a mission to collect copies of all of the materials worldwide related to the development of the Lower Mississippi Valley.
Yeah.
And so he spent years developing that microfilm collection, but it just came to the point where it was more appropriate to transfer it over to the library archives.
Got it. Yeah. Got it. You know, now, excuse my ignorance on some, but things that were, you know, on microfilm, is that stuff then all digitized or that remains on
microfilm? That was part of the problem is the ability to digitize that, and we didn't have those capabilities. It's very difficult to digitize that kind of material.
And the legalities.
Yeah,
there's certain questions of copyright and who owns the materials. And then it's time consuming, as you might imagine.
Yeah,
we're talking thousands of microfilms with millions of documents on them. And we don't have the staff.
But some of the archives, because like Pud said, the legalities, we really couldn't because we didn't own the original document. It was a copy. So it's like making a copy of a copy, which is technically illegal.
Yeah.
So some of the archives where those original materials are held are digitizing that and making those available.
Got it. Okay. Yes. But you still have – go ahead, John.
Right, exactly. The Archive of Cajun Creole Folklore that we were talking about, we have around 15,000 hours of digitized material. And that's another reason that amount of material and the time to deal with that. Plus we approximate another 15,000 hours of material to be digitized.
Oh.
So, you know, spending a lot of time with that meant that we had so much to do with that. We had less time to spend with the other records.
Yeah.
So they're better suited to be in the university archives, really.
So how – you know, I mean, when I hear that and I hear how many hours you have left, you know, to be digitized, you know, seriously, how you – and for me it would be calming myself – how would I calm myself down and prioritize, you know?
You know, strangely, we find that very exciting. No. You know, instead of a daunting task, we say, you know, we're excited for the things to come. And we know that it's the tip of the iceberg, that we're still just, you know, getting things coming in at a very good pace.
So the material that you have in that's waiting, that's a combination of like, do you have reel-to-reel kind of stuff?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, right.
Sure.
Reel-to-reel, cassette, everything.
Right. The material in the archive goes from things that came from wax cylinders to things that are recorded digitally. You know, so it really spans the – I mean, in a way, we're kind of like an archive of old equipment, and,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And Chris Segura in particular is really good at keeping those old things in working order and making those things work. And not only that, but being able to get a great sound and also to know exactly the history of the material. Like, we're so lucky to have Chris as the archivist because he already knows that he doesn't have to figure out what the song is.
He's a
walking songbook.
Yes. I'm curious, what happens to – okay, once that those materials are digitized, then what happens to the old reel-to-reel or the old
– they get put in acid-free. Well, they're cleaned to be digitized, and they get put in on special reels, and then they go into acid-free cases, and then those cases go in a big a big storage locker.
Is that up on the third floor too?
It sure is. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's in the back.
No, wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you know, that's the other thing that I think when people go up there and you tour, it's much larger than you know.
Yeah.
You know, when you get to start walking through some of the other doors, it's like, oh my gosh. Like, James, when I got to your area the first time, it was, oh my God, I had no idea all that was up there.
As our back catalog is growing, I mean, that's more space in terms of backstock of the books. We're one of the few academic publishers that still handle our own distribution. A lot of them have outsourced those opportunities. And so, unlike some other publishers in state, those are still providing jobs for people.
That's right. You know, that's right.
Where they had to cut.
Yeah, exactly.
So we still send all the books out from our office.
Yeah.
And that also means people can stop by the office and actually buy the books.
Yeah. So they can. You can come to your office and purchase.
Yeah. And get 40% off tomorrow.
And get 40% off tomorrow. There you go. Let's talk a bit more about tomorrow, and then I want to make sure we mention a couple other events that you do have coming up. So tomorrow you do have the open house. Mm-hmm. But then can we talk about tomorrow afternoon?
Yes.
And the half-day symposium, absolutely. What all is going on with that?
Yeah. Well, so we're going to borrow our neighbor's space. The Louisiana Room. It's actually called the Jefferson Caffrey Reading Room. And use their facility to...
That's up on the third floor.
It's right next to it.
Right?
Yep.
Okay.
In fact, sort of in between our two office suites.
Is that where Daryl Bork did his... when his book came out? Was that in that area
that was
or no?
That was the Gaines Center.
Oh, that was... That's right.
Also
that was
on the
there.
Third floor.
Okay.
But on the other end of the
other
building.
Side. Yeah. Okay.
We'll have four sessions as part of this symposium. The very first one will be on the history of the center and its significant collections. As speaking on that will be some of the founders of the center, as well as some folks who've been affiliated with the center for almost 40 years. Those people are Barry Ancelet, who's rightly called the founder of the Archive of Cajun and Creole Folklore, Vaughn Baker, who's retired from the history department but was there at the inception of the center, Mate Alain, who taught for many, many years in the Modern Languages Department and was involved in the center from the get-go, and David Berry, who also was in Modern Languages as a faculty member, was involved in some center projects, and then, of course, when he was dean for 15, almost 20 years maybe, oversaw the activities of the center as dean of liberal arts. So we'll have those four talking about the history. Then we'll shift gears and focus a little bit more specifically on some of the divisions of the center. So from 2:15 until about 2:45, we'll have Susan Larson in from New Orleans to talk about the UL Press and kind of the state of modern publishing.
What's her connection?
Susan Larson is the former book editor of the Times-Picayune, and she's the host of The Reading Life on WWNO. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Very nice.
Which is, as far as I know, it's the only reading show based out of Louisiana.
There may be another one.
Yeah, there might be. Red but River it's Radio, it's the main one. I mean, Susan is a is an opinion maker when it comes to books, and she is someone who has devoted her life, a bit like James, to books as something that you're passionate about.
Yeah, yeah.
So she'll come in and talk about the press and maybe try to fit us into a broader perspective.
Sure.
Then after that, we'll have a session where myself and the assistant directors and associate director will talk about our plans for the future, what we think the future holds for the center as a whole and then the various divisions. That's when we'll be making that big announcement because it pertains to our future.
Yeah.
I've kind of purposely asked them not to tell me what they're going to say because I hope this is kind of a discussion process.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
And we're always looking for input from the audience and from people who share the same passions that we do.
Sure.
And then finally, we'll wrap up with a session on inspiration, we're calling it.
Yeah.
We've got some musicians who have used the archives of Cajun and Creole folklore either to inspire themselves or to actually find songs that then they can record for albums. They'll be talking about why those archives matter, how that helps them to be creative artists, and you know how it's affected their careers.
Yeah.
So we'll have Christy Guillory, who used to work at the center. She was an archivist here, and she'll be functioning kind of as a moderator. David Greeley, Steve Riley, Anne Savoie, and Jane Vigerine.
Very nice.
Yeah. And then that'll wrap it up.
Yeah,
that'll end at about 4:45.
Oh, that'll be a good afternoon.
Yeah.
So that all takes place tomorrow, November 6th, at the third floor of the Dupre Library here at the University of Louisiana Lafayette campus. And again, it starts in the morning with their open house from 9 to 11:30. So that's going to be a full day there.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, wonderful. Let's talk, too, a bit about some other events that you do have. And this is where, you know, we look at the programming end of that. You offer programming year-round.
Pretty much, yes.
You know, and I think one of the most popular ones that, you know, a lot of people have started attending now is the Backyard Series that you do.
Yeah.
Can you tell, for folks that haven't been to that before, can you talk a little bit about that?
The Backyard Series is something that we've been doing for 5 years now almost. We're on number 58, so getting close to the 60th one.
Yeah.
It's a monthly series on the second Tuesday of the month, held at Vermilionville in their Performance Center at 6:30 in the evenings. It's basically an opportunity for us to connect academia and the university with the community, a time to focus on culture and history and folklore, among other things, of South Louisiana, and acknowledge maybe some of the things that we overlook just because we live here.
Mm-hmm.
You hear a lot of people say, you know, people from the outside saying, you don't realize what you have here.
That's right.
Or you don't realize until you leave. And I know I experienced that.
Yeah.
So it's a way of looking at those things in your own backyard.
Yeah.
And discussing them and learning more about them. And maybe, hopefully, learning enough about them that you can then kind of pass it on to the next generation.
And I think, too, you know, topics that really educate people on the history of this area, but it's also topics that are things that can currently be used today. You know, like think of the one that you did with the gardening, you know, and taking a look at some of, you know, some of the old ways, but how that adds into today's gardening and the things that are produced. And it's a wonderful series. And it does make people stop and think of, you know, we all get caught in our day-to-day lives and you forget about a lot of those wonderful things that, you know, that are out there.
And I think we have to give credit to Jennifer Guidry for that. Part of the thing when Jennifer would put an entire year together at one time with topics, and part of the reason that some of the topics get chosen would be because, Jennifer would say, "Do what do you know about this topic, and then we would all have to admit, oh, we don't really know anything about
it.
So we said, well, hey, let's use that as this opportunity to have the, you know, the best people we can find come in and educate us and, you know, the community about these things.
Very nice. Very nice. Now, you have Archive Aid is coming up here real soon. That's November 15th.
That's right. Actually, before we get to that, the Backyard Series is actually coming up next Tuesday.
Oh, it is? Oh, okay. Yeah.
So even before Archive Aid, we have another Backyard Series event. This one will be focused on the UL Lafayette Traditional Music Ensemble. So Professor Mark DeWitt will be bringing the various ensembles that he's put together, which usually have a professional musician at the lead, but amateurs as the students. And so they'll be showcasing their talents.
Is that going to be at Vermilionville also?
Yes. Yeah.
Right? Okay.
So,
boy, great in the Performance Center.
Absolutely.
Beautiful place there.
And you know, it's a great place for the students themselves to showcase their talents.
Yeah. See, that's what I talked about earlier. It's amazing what all comes out, what all comes out of that center, you know, because in things like that, you know, you take a look at the backyard, that stuff doesn't just happen.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's, you know, I know what it takes to set up programs and things, and it's very time consuming.
It's time consuming, a lot of work, a lot of effort.
Yeah.
Not only making the logistical arrangements of it, but getting the word out.
Exactly.
Basically marketing it.
See, and that's the thing too. I'm going to go back to what you talked about, James. The whole the marketing that you do for the Backyard Series, it's a great look. Mm. It has a really nice look to it, and so you know, kudos to that because it's going across the board.
Thank you.
With the look you're doing,
Now, as far as the Archive Aid, so every year we host a fundraiser for the Archives of Cajun and Creole Folklore. Many of our operations receive basically no operational budget. I mean, we have staff salaries, and the center itself receives a small operational budget from the university. But a lot of the things like the Backyard Series and the books, we either have to find some sort of external funding, or in the case of publishing books, we have to find something that's going to pay for itself. And if it does really well, maybe help pay for some other books. So we're very proud of the fact that we're self-sustaining in many of our operations. But part of that means we have to engage in fundraisers, you know, much like KRVS and other entities. So Archive Aid is something that we've now been doing for – this will be our 10th one. So it's a kind of milestone event. It's at the Blue Moon Saloon next Friday, which is Friday, November 15th. We'll have, as usual, we'll have a number of different bands, many of which are in some ways connected with the center and specifically with the archives, whether they've drawn inspiration from there or they have deeper connections with the center. They're somehow affiliated with it. It's a $10 admission fee. We'll have T-shirts and things like that.
It's always really cool T-shirts too.
Yeah, they are.
Posters.
They're really,
really cool.
They're nice and trendy T-shirts too.
They,
you know, the people they like everything else. It's partly about the marketing.
Yeah,
element. We'll have free food if you get there and you pay to come in. You're going to be dining on food that's prepared by an archivist. Chris will be actually around back cooking up meals for
and
us.
And our intern, Adam Ducey.
Yeah, and Adam.
Will also be cooking?
That's right.
Very nice.
Yeah, so – and then there are
going to be – Did you screen him for that before you provided the internship to him?
Well
– That was a given.
Yeah. Can you cook?
Yeah, that's first and foremost on our questions we ask when there's interns involved. What can you cook and
that's
how well
right.
can you do it? So there's food, there's music, there's dancing. It's going to be an all-night affair. The first band will take the stage at 7:45, I think.
And that band is the Rec Street Rounders?
Yes.
Which is a band composed of History Department and Center for Louisiana Studies people such as Dr. Michael Martin right here.
So do you play an instrument?
I try, yes.
What do you play?
I play guitar.
Very cool.
I sing a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, this was something that happened a couple of years ago, three now. We realized just in the history department we had a drummer, two guitars, and a bass player. And so we started out just saying, well, we'll do this for fun. only for fun.
Yeah.
We're not going to try to make it too complicated. But then we realized, you know, we all know very, very well the benefits of archives and the uses of archives. And so why not go out and, you know, bring in some people who maybe wouldn't necessarily typically come to the Blue Moon Saloon.
Yeah.
But will come just to see,
you guys.
A bunch of history professors.
Yeah. Who else is in that?
Now the Dean of Liberal Arts, Jordan Kelman.
Okay.
Associate Professor of History, John Troutman. And Assistant Professor of History, Chad Parker.
Okay.
And we have a recent graduate of our MA program who is now working in the Graduate Studies College by the name of Sean Thibodeau.
Very nice. Yeah.
But so there will also be other bands like the Revelers.
The Revelers.
Well, who cares now, huh?
Yeah,
I mean, the Revelers.
Well,
wait.
You will.
The Revelers.
The Revelers with a very special guest, a good friend of the archive, Johnny Allen.
So nice. Oh, yeah. That'll be very cool.
Yeah, that's going to be really great.
Yeah, very good.
And then closing out the evening will be Bonsoir Cote.
Ah, good deal. Yes. Good deal. And that makes sense with all those gals because they really they live that.
That's right.
I mean, they live what the center's all about. Yeah. So I'd go ahead.
And then we have one other event coming up the day after Archive.
See,
Aid.
Look.
It's the NOLA Book Fair. And I'll let James maybe talk a little bit about that.
Well, we have two book events coming up. The NOLA Book Fair in New Orleans at the Contemporary Arts Center on November 16th from 11 to 5. But then here locally, we have our annual holiday book sale, which is December 10th at the Alumni Center.
Very cool.
So we'll have all our usual holiday sale and events, and a lot of our authors will be coming out signed copies.
Oh, very nice.
Zachary Richard, Dennis Paul Williams, you know, a lot of the locally related titles will be showcased there.
Good deal, good deal. So I do want to mention again, tomorrow, November 6th, open house, third floor, Dupre Library for the Center for Louisiana Studies. It is their 40th anniversary, 9 to 11:30 a.m., but stick around for the afternoon because a number of wonderful panel discussions on what that center is all about. And get out to Archive Aid on the 15th, and prior to that, we have the Backyard Series.
On the 12th.
On the 12th.
A week from today.
All right. We're going to go out. I want to thank Dr. Michael Martin. I want to thank John Pud Sharp and James Wilson, all with the Center for Louisiana Studies. Fabulous what you do out there. And we're going to go out listening to Clamo, King Ned Norman.
King Ned Norman. King Ned.
All right. Everybody have a good week.